One True Pairing by a Damn Scientist, rated G. Voted Best Comedy Medium, third place in the 2011 Terra Firma Fanfiction Awards. A couple of strangers wake up imprisoned in cell aboard Moya. Some ships were just meant to be. One True Pairing. Just how hard could the floor of a cell in a Leviathan be? Grunschlick wondered as consciousness returned to him. Fairly, or some other word beginning with F, he mused. Still, these things happen when a group of assorted aliens who see you as their enemy knock you out, strip you of your clothes, and dump you naked on a cell floor. He knew he shouldn't have trusted Sokozu. He suspected she was still a little unhappy about some of the details of their business arrangements after the Scarran Peacekeeper War. As he sat up, he realized that he was being watched from beyond the gratings of the cell door by a wrinkly, green, and probably female creature with one too many eyes. "Where are my clothes?" he demanded in what he hoped was an intimidating growl. Grunschlick wasn't the type of hard-headed businessman who would allow himself to show any weakness, but he was a little uncomfortable about his naked form being stared at by this old woman. She might get overexcited at the sight, and he wouldn't want to have to deal with that. "I don't need to talk to you," snapped the figure beyond the door, "but seeing as you have to listen to me, I shall. Your clothes are piled over there." She pointed to a corner of the cell. "The others wanted to search you, you see, and then they insisted on laundering your clothes." The old woman seemed to shudder, as though she had said something distasteful. Grunschlick looked to where she had indicated, and saw that his clothes were indeed piled there, neatly laundered. "You'll be pleased to know that I saved you from the bath they were threatening to give you, though," the third eye in the middle of her forehead now glowing red. "You had some rather unusual microorganisms growing on your skin," she continued, "and on each other," she added as an afterthought, unconcerned that he was now rapidly dressing and seemed not to be listening to her. "It would have been a crime to have washed them away. You'll be pleased to know I took samples." "Fascinating!" Grunschlick shuddered, and having finished his hurried dressing, approached the door. "You should let me go. I'm no threat to you," he whined. "Look, I wouldn't even know how to hurt you." The old woman scowled in reply. "No," she snapped, "we can no more trust you than we can trust that." She spat out the last word, indicating a large pile of washed-out-looking rags in the corner. Grunschlick looked towards the hillock-shaped pile she had indicated. The mound moved slightly and then let out a groan. Then it stretched out to its full length, which really didn't change its appearance or shape that much. A head slowly emerged from the mess of fabric, its bulbous white irised eyes staring out at nothing in particular. A hand crawled to the figure's head to remove a small greasy skull cap, allowing a few wispy, dirty blonde curls of hair to escape and frame the face of what Grunschlick now realised was a female. She stared at the ground in front of her and scratched her scalp as though she were tufting up the hair on the top of her head, and then she replaced the cap. "Another fine mess," she seemed to mutter. "I should have let them clean her up, though," sneered the voice from the three-eyed old woman outside the cell door. "The smell was quite appalling." The old woman shuddered at some memory. "Anyway, I have to go for a pee, but I'll tell the others you're awake," she added, and walked off. Grunschlick barely heard the sound of his strange captor's departing feet, as all his attention was now on the vision before him. A sebaceanoid figure was slowly becoming apparent as his cellmate rose to her feet, allowing Grunschlick to determine that she was his sort of woman, curved in all the places, right or wrong. "Hello, little lady. My name is Grunschlick, and it seems we have a..." he began in greeting, but he never finished what he was saying as she interrupted him. "Trog stolen my helmet," she muttered indignantly to herself as her stare settled on him. "Trog?" Grunschlick echoed. "Maybe the same one that locked you up," she suggested. "Sokozu," snarled Grunschlick, curling his lip. "Don't rightly know the name. Scrawny little redhead, Kalish." "Can't say as I like her already," she replied. "But you know, you and me, we'd get on a whole lot better if you didn't spit in my face when you talk," the bulging-eyed woman added, with a grin, rolling her head as though it might fall off, and wiping something from under her eye with her hand. Grunschlick was silent and inwardly crestfallen for a microt before he realized she was teasing him. He returned the grin and replied in kind. "You're a fine one to talk, you know. You could do with using the dentic a little bit more often yourself." Truth be told, Grunschlick quite liked her aggressive bantering manner, and he reckoned, from the look in her eye, that she was quite taken with him, too. "Smooth talker, huh? I like that in a man, she batted back. What's your name, he barked. I don't see how that's any concern of yours, she responded with a smirk, rolling her cue ball eyes this time instead of her head. Yes, she definitely liked him, he thought. Then she waited just long enough to prove that she didn't have to give her name before saying, and it's Furlough, by the way. My name. Splendid! And what they want you for then, Miss Furlough, he replied chirpily. Furlough looked him up and down, sizing him up. There was certainly something interesting about the way he filled out his trousers, she thought. Grunschlick gawped straight back at her. She seemed to be eyeing him up and down appreciatively, or so he thought, and it gave him a little thrill. This and that. That crazy peacekeeper has got some bug in her breeches, going on about my killing her Johnny boy. I mean, how dumb is that? He's obviously alive, so what's the problem? And you? Oh, nothing, nothing, he replied. Furlough gave him a disbelieving smile, forcing Grunschlick to consider expanding on nothing. This Sokozo, she's all upset about the deal we struck to get off the water planet. She keeps on about me taking unfair advantage. Me? I'm just an honest businessman. Honest business? Now that I can understand, Furlough replied, making for the door grill. Give me a hand up. I want to see if we can reach the mechanism at the top. Might be able to force it open. Splendid, he replied. Reluctantly, and with much panting and gasping on Furlough's part, Grunschlick hefted Furlough's ample form upwards. Have you ever thought of going on a diet? He couldn't help from commenting, despite his desire to curry favour with her. Although he was easily strong enough to lift her, she was difficult to keep aloft, as whatever and wherever he grabbed kept shifting disconcertingly beneath his hands. No, have you? She replied evenly, and take your hand off my... Suddenly, Grunschlick's grip slipped irrecoverably, and the pair tumbled floorwards. Grunschlick had the wind knocked out of him, taking a couple of microts to register that he was now lying on his back, with Furlough sitting atop him, his arms pinned by her ample legs. This isn't gonna work, Furlough observed. Don't reckon you're man enough to boost me up there. Not like some others that I could name, she finished with a wistful smile. Oi! Protested Grunschlick, and started to raise himself upwards, forcing her up at the same time and thus proving his strength. Then his anger subsided as his eager eyes watched Furlough stand up and step back towards the door. You're hungry, he called after her. Do I look hungry? Always get a good meal when you can, that's my motto, she replied, turning and rolling her head from side to side, as if that were the dumbest question it was possible to ask. Grunschlick grinned and drooled a little in reply as he joined her at the cell door. Never know when you'll get another. Oi, old woman, we need to eat, Grunschlick bellowed down the corridor. A few microts later came the sound of approaching feet. Eat what? Came the uneasy response from Furlough, who was cautiously eyeing him up and down once again. By then, the old woman had appeared back at the grating. Looks to me as if you've both eaten quite enough of just about everything already, she muttered. Furlough and Grunschlick both protested strongly at that. The old woman merely smiled and touched her comms. Officer Sun, our guests are awake and hungry. Good, I will be along shortly, came the clipped and ice-cold voice from the comms. 500 microts later, Furlough and Grunschlick found themselves handcuffed, shackled, and being shepherded along towards the central chamber by Eren and Naranti. Although they would probably have derived some comfort from knowing that Naranti's pulse pistol was customarily empty, that would have been instantly offset by the knowledge that Eren's weapon most certainly was not. As the prisoners approached the censored chamber, two voices engaged in heated exchange became audible. One was clearly that of Crichton, with his alien tones. The other was a strident female voice that Grunschlick immediately recognized as belonging to Sokozu. Told you before, the Pavlovian spheres are extremely valued as energy sources. The Hecathians will pay handsomely for them, protested Sokozu. And we've told you before, we absolutely will not deal with Hecathians, no matter how much those spheres are worth. Period. End of discussion. And you know why. But we could be rich beyond your wildest dreams, and they're just sitting down there in Cargo Bay 4, taking up space. At that point, Furlough, Grunschlick, and their escorts entered the center chamber. John angrily indicated to Sokozu that they should end their conversation. Sokozu harrumphed, glowered at John, stared daggers at Grunschlick, and then flounced from the chamber. I'm guessing that Sokozu, asked Furlough. Don't know what Johnny sees in all these bags of bones. She's nothing but trouble, that one, Grunschlick nodded, and then grinned as he turned to John. Tell you what, I'll gladly take her back off your hands. You know, for a small fee. John snorted and ignored them both, turning to Erin. Was our cell okay? I mean, I know it's the only one still with good locks, but the thought of having these two in it... It's fine, John, Erin reassured him, although her slightly sharp tone and delivery betrayed that she thought he was focusing on an irrelevance. You sit, she ordered, turning her attention to the prisoners, and shut up. I don't need your conversation, she added, waving her pulse rifle in a way which brooked no argument. Furlough and Grunschlick wisely did as they were told, as quickly as their wrist and ankle restraints allowed. Half an hour later, the edge taken off their appetites, Furlough and Grunschlick found themselves alone, restraints removed, and back in their cell. Furlough grinned at her companion in what she hoped was a winsome manner. You know, I think I've got an idea, she said. What? I've got a proposition. Help me get off this ship, and I'll split the proceeds with you.
What proceeds?
The proceeds from selling them Pavlovian spheres, which we'll take with us, she explained. Grunschlick frowned in incomprehension. You were listening, right? Pavlovian spheres? Hocadians? Large amounts of money? And Cargo Bay 4 is next to the docking bay where they have my transport.
Ah, Pavlovian spheres, Hocadians. Large profit to be had. Splendid, echoed Grunschlick, the penny finally dropping.
Unfortunately, we're both locked in this cell.
Not for long, grinned Grunschlick, pulling a full cutlery setting from the sleeves of his scruffy tunic.
That's enough. I'm not risking staying on this crazy ship a micro longer than I have to, declared Furlough.
But there's three more, protested Grunschlick, as he pointed to the three remaining spheres in the cargo bay. They're very small spheres.
Don't be greedy, Grunschlick. Always be the one to walk away while the greedy one gets caught, she suggested, giving him a friendly pat on the butt. That's my motto. Tempted though he was to go for just one more sphere, Grunschlick had to confess that maybe she had a point. The rear of Furlough's transport was already packed with more than half a dozen of the rough brown spheres. Each of them stood as tall as Furlough and was considerably more rotund. But the couple's luck in not being discovered by Moya's crew couldn't last forever. Besides, it had been a difficult process getting even that many spheres, as neither of the duo had been willing to allow the other to be alone with the transport, and thus have the opportunity to flee with the spheres, but without their new business partner. Grunschlick had to admire Furlough's head for such intricacies of a business arrangement. She was his kind of woman. If these spheres were truly valuable, half a dozen should give them a good return. She was right. It was time to take their profits and go. He followed her back to the docking bay and her beaten-up old transport pod. Once aboard, Grunschlick lowered himself into the co-pilot's seat, an exact copy of that for the pilot. Both looked as if they'd been made for overweight Scarrans, perhaps Scarrans that had eaten too much fattening, frozy, creamy dessert, if such a thing were possible. Furlough activated a gizmo to override the docking bay door control, and soon afterwards they were free and flying, heading towards the refuge of a nearby planet.
Hang on, muttered Grunschlick. What's that?
He asked, pointing towards a blip on one of the displays in front of him. Furlough glanced across, smug nonchalance draining from her face as she registered the blip.
Well, I reckon it's that stupid peacekeeper, Tralk. We're going to have to take evasive action. Hold on.
With that, Furlough started frantically working the flight controls, pouring on the speed and jinking around in an effort to dodge their pursuer. Grunschlick was impressed with her success when first pulse cannon fire and then the unmistakable form of a prowler shot past them. But even as they flew past, their pursuer was already slowing and banking to make a return pass. Furlough piled on the manoeuvres, throwing the transport from side to side and up and down, her teeth clenched in grim determination. So focused was she on the matter at hand that, unlike Grunschlick, she didn't hear the spheres banging into each other behind them, or the strange accompanying sound which resembled that of eggshells breaking.
Furlough, what's that horrible smell? Grunschlick asked, wrinkling his nose.
Not now, can't you see? Furlough replied as she threw the craft violently downwards to avoid another pass from the prowler. But if she'd been planning on finishing her sentence, she never got there. As the transport pitched downwards, an ominous sound of cracking and shattering came from behind them. A split microt later, a wave of thick, dark green and nauseatingly pungent fluid swept from the now broken spheres to engulf pilot, co-pilot and console alike. Grunschlick screamed. Furlough vomited. The foul, clinging fluid found its way into ears, up nostrils, and into every crack and crevice. And there it clung, like malodorous, malevolent green honey. 10 microns later, the transport lay still in space, its occupants no longer able to focus on anything, even their escape. The prowler drew up alongside and hailed them. After about 20 microns, Furlow summoned enough control over her spasming body to open the channel. "Furlow, Gruntrick, what's your status?" came Aaron's commanding voice. The only reply from the shuttle was a deep retching from Gruntrick. Neither Gruntrick nor Furlow had enough of a clear head to wonder why Aaron had stopped firing on them. "Gruntrick, is that you?" came Sikosu's voice, sounding smugger and even more annoying than Gruntrick had ever remembered her. "You don't sound well." "Frelling Pavlovian spheres cracked. Request urgent assistance," Furlow managed to gasp out. "Pavlovian balls?" "Never heard of them," Aaron replied, her voice a paragon of honesty. "Sounds like the sort of dren John would come out with. Sikosu, you're the tech. Have you?" "I have never heard of them either, but Pilot did report that several of the spheres that Moya produces when she excretes her metabolic waste have gone missing." "The Leviathan dren? But why would anyone take those?" Aaron replied with exaggerated innocence. "They are quite worthless." "And famously fragile," added Sikosu. "Ah, yes, famously fragile," concurred Aaron, rubbing it in. "You lied," Furlow gasped out. "Lied? Me? No, never," Aaron replied, apparently affronted. "The others, though, they're always making up stories. I may have to limit the amount of television they watch." "You have to help us. Help us," pleaded Gruntrick. "Absolutely not. Once you get that stuff on you, I've heard it can take weekends to scrub it off again," declared Sikosu. "Yeah, could be more," Aaron sniffed pointedly, perhaps gloating now from the sound of her voice. "Moanin's even." "But the smell," protested Furlow. "Exactly, but I'm confident you'll both get used to it," replied Sikosu, smirking. "Maybe we should attach a warning beacon to this shuttle," Aaron suggested, deliberately leaving the comms open while she continued talking to Sikosu. "For the sake of any passers-by, I think we need to declare this shuttle and its crew to be irreversibly contaminated." "I actually have just the thing prepared," confirmed Sikosu. "Good. Excellent foresight," concluded Aaron, edging the prowler closer to the transport to attach the beacon. "You can't put that beacon on our ship. People will want to kill us," pleaded Furlow. "You'll be fine," soothed Aaron, as the beacon latched onto the transport with a dull thud. "After all, it's only people who know you that want to kill you. Still, it will ruin your chances of making a clean getaway this time. Sorry." The end.